particularly biologic material, is an extremely good absorber at the frequency range of 30 to 300. Out of curiosity, you may get a kick out of the fact that microwaves, these really dangerous higher frequency, you say those words in front of any zoning board and they'll believe you immediately. Pound for pound is 5 to 1 safer. From 1500 megacycles and above of all the radio energy that hits your body, 20% of it is absorbed and turned into heat. 80% of it reflects off your skin. Doesn't even penetrate. The so-called microwave frequencies that everybody shudders and has got this great fear of. You're not going to set up a microwave transmitter in my neighborhood, are you? 5 to 1 safer frequency region than the 30 to 300 megs. The cell phone is more dangerous than microwave, if you know what I mean. I mean, lots of people have got emotional responses to all of this material, and a lot of misunderstanding takes place.
Repeater, timeout.
You guys may have some further questions or comments. I'm going to take your calls right now if you do have questions or comments, and after that I'm going to give a nice long drop in case anyone out of the area wants to join us. K2RIW in the second end, we're listening.
Al, this is K2KEY. I heard something on 75 meters the other night, and I don't know if it's an early April Fool's joke or whatever, Dick, but it sounded pretty serious and about so-called radiation from radio equipment. Over.
Okay, I'm going to ask you for a blow-by-blow description. By the way, you could use a little bit more audio, Mel. Your audio, whenever I listen to the recordings, is quite a few dB weaker than my audio. I think my audio is almost filling out the repeater, and you're a couple of dB weaker than that. I know that a brand new onslaught is coming down toward us because there's been a couple of articles recently of people in various places in the world claiming that their cell phone did them damage. There's also an article which lists the 100 or so popular models and brand names of cell phones and lists the specific absorption rate, the amount of radio energy that gets absorbed into your body when you use each one of those model numbers and brand names. Unfortunately, Motorola, for instance, their particular cell phones, some of them were near the top of the list, coming close to the United States standard, which is 1.6 watts per kilogram, and I think they ran up to as high as 1.4. And people were saying, aha, you shouldn't buy this particular cell phone because it's going to give you more absorption. Well, if you look down that whole list of 100 cell phones that have been rated, they go from like 1.4 all the way down to 0.3. And so if it was only specific absorption rate you're worried about, you would think you should go out and buy the 0.3 watts per kilogram of absorption rate cell phone. You do that, that's the one with the weaker signal output, and you're going to have the least amount of coverage. That's a weaker cell phone, which now, as you drive around with your automobile with that cell phone, and of course it is your passenger using the cell phone, not you, as you drive around with your automobile, there's going to be more dropouts because the cell phone runs a much lower power. You can't have it both ways. If you want good radio communication, you have to have an efficient signal radiator. If you have an efficient signal radiator and your body is going to be nearby, you're going to acquire a specific absorption rate. That's it. And if you think you're going to control the antenna battery inside of a cell phone, if you really think you're going to do that, and if you think you've got a product that does that, as soon as you buy that product, I want you to also buy some stock that I own in the Brooklyn Bridge. I'll sell you that too. Because the cell phone is, in its physical size, so small compared to the wavelengths involved, the cell phone...
Repeater, timeout.
In the case of the 800 and 900 megacycle service of a cell phone, where the wavelength is something like 14 inches, and that cell phone in your hand is only 5 inches long and 3 inches wide, within that very tiny size, you think you're going to set up an antenna? Yeah, you can do that. And if you think you're going to make a directional pattern of that antenna so it aims all the signal away from your body, you don't have the resources to do that. It takes real estate. You have to have multiple wavelengths of reflector or other transmitting devices in order to control the directivity pattern, in order to control the gain and where the signal is aimed. You don't have the resources with a cell phone. You take any cell phone and you put it into the right kind of laboratory instrumentation, and you look at the radiated pattern, and you plot it as a three-dimensional device. It looks like a round apple with a little bit of a null in one particular direction off the edge of the antenna. It's an apple with a stem coming out of it, if you know what I mean. Almost all cell phones are almost an omnidirectional radiator when you figure out what's going on. So once you accept the fact that you're not going to control the pattern, and if you do try to control the specific absorption rate, you're limiting the power output of the cell phone, therefore you're limiting its range, and you're going to have more dropout regions. It's very similar to everybody saying, I don't want that cell phone base station in my backyard. Not in my backyard. Well, then you're going to be in a dead zone. If there's no cell phones in your neighborhood, then your neighborhood is not going to have good cell phone coverage. Can't have it both ways. A smart guy will realize that when he looks at that beautiful piece of hardware that you and I call cell phone, base station, that's what makes the system work, and the presence of that machine will save lives. As simple as that. And even if it's directly next door to you, it's the safest thing in the world. The least safe thing, if you want to talk about safety, is the thing that's slapped up against your head by inverse square law, is giving you 1 million times more energy into your body, that cell phone, than if you live directly next door to the cell phone base station. That concept that we radio people understand is highly misunderstood in the non-technical world. We're going to have to slowly educate that world, because we are the radio experts. We can call ourselves that because there are so few other experts around that are giving out reasonable information. So tell me about the story on 80 meters. And by the way, 80 meters from time...
Repeater, time out.
From time to time, Mel, 80 meters has got some real whoppers, particularly things like loop antennas and how to properly feed them. Give a nice long drop in case anyone out of area wants to join us, Mel. K2KEY with a little bit of delay. K2LIW on the TechNet. I heard an extremely weak signal. Want to make one more try? Okay, I did hear Kilo 2 Echo Lima. You were 90% noise, 10% audio, very low audio, very noisy signal. If you could move to a slightly different location or make some kind of a change, and if I'm able to copy you, the next thing I'd like to know is what is your handle? K2 Echo Lima, question mark, K2RIW. Okay, I can tell that you made another attempt. Whatever you did was 10 decibels worse. Zero audio copy that time. I'm going to go over to Mel now, and you'll have a chance to make some kind of a change. Bear in mind, if you're using a handy-talkie, for instance, when you move around so that you get the strongest signal into your handy-talkie, it may not be the best location for giving the best transmission, because the transmission is a different frequency than the reception. Therefore, those nulls in space fall into a different location. With that information, maybe you'll be able to make an improvement. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead with a little bit of delay first. Go right ahead, Eric.
Disapprove the point from the other day. Transmit without your PL. You'll find it works.
Okay, I'm now making a transmission without PL. That's a good thing to know. So for the few people out there who don't have a PL tone generator, you will be able to talk to this particular TechNet during this brief period of time. I think almost all the other time this particular repeater is in the PL required mode. Okay, Mel to pick up, K2LIW.
One more thing, Dick.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, now you don't notice it, but, okay, what's going on here, if you actually will go look at the links that we have set up on the internet, you'll find out that they've dropped out, and fortunately I have it so that it will reconnect, but the radio links drop out after 4 minutes of transmission. The actual timeout that's occurring when you hear a repeated timeout is 2 minutes and 40 seconds. guys got to be a little more careful about letting this stuff drop. People just come bang, bang, bang. The thing never recycles. You think it recycled, but it didn't. When the radio link breaks, it takes about 3 or 4 minutes before it comes back, and the poor guy in Las Vegas is listening to it, has to dial it back up. K2RWK, Tweeter.
Okay, Eric. In which case, we should, every 2 and a fraction minutes, 2 minutes and 40 seconds, sometime in there, we should give a longer dropout. What is your recommended period of time that we not transmit, that we do a pause? How long should that pause be, in your expert opinion? Go ahead, Eric.
When you listen to the courtesy tone, that is an adequate period of time. But what happens is you'll call something, somebody will come in, they'll say, well, what about this? And then somebody will pick it up without it doing again. And then another person will pick it up. Also, at the time when you ask for stations out there, it will be, you know, one call sign after another call sign after another call sign and every recycle.
Okay. If we pause long enough to hear the beginning of the courtesy tone, is that enough? Or should we wait till the end of the courtesy tone and an additional time beyond that? Over to you, Eric.
Now, this particular tone is about 400 milliseconds. That's adequate. When you hear this, when you first hear the courtesy tone, it's been long enough.
Okay, Joe recognized the V2RYY. We're going to pick you up right after Mel. Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead. And wait that long enough period.
This is K2KEY. All right. Very good. What did I hear on 75? Well, it was serious enough discussion. In Germany, they all of a sudden, here we go again with some other ridiculous things involving microwaves. They found that some people that are working in the microwave industry on transmitters especially have family members like children, wives, and children that have a higher amount of cancer. Believe it or not, they some way came up with this formula, according to this person who sounded fairly serious about it, and he was citing certain studies and whatnot, and they actually alluding to the fact that you become, if you're working in the industry, working on the RF circuits, the microwave circuits, you bring home some kind of a condition. In other words, a Typhoid Mary type of condition, Dick. And they actually are really now taking this fairly serious from what I understand, over.
Now give me a couple of words. From what you heard on 75 meters, is this a respected report in a peer-reviewed journal somewhere in Europe? I mean, do we know the origin of this opinion you heard on 75 meters? Back to you, Mel.
Well, I caught some of it, maybe more towards the tail end of it, because there were some questions being thrown back and forth in a group that gets together. And basically, I was doing some other things, so I was not really at my transmitter that I could, you know, actually ask maybe some questions. But I understand the incident were recorded in Germany, and that these people actually found in their family, they couldn't understand in certain families, an exceedingly amount of extra cancers, especially brain cancer, amongst siblings of the people that are employed in the microwave industry, especially in the transmitting portion of the industry. And so they actually are alluding to the fact that almost like they said, it's a, you remember the Typhoid Mary syndrome, how they had to take this person, actually quarantine her whole entire life because she carried typhoid but never got it herself. And so they're alluding to the fact, basically, this is what's happening. These people are bringing home a disease via microwaves. I heard this, I almost flipped out. I said, I haven't never heard anything as ridiculous as this, but some way it became a serious subject, Dick, over.
Okay, you, I, and anyone else hearing us are going to have to do a little bit more of a website search or whatever to find out is this real and is this authoritative? Because radio and the effects of radio on human beings have been rather extensively studied for 60 solid years in every single high technology country on planet Earth. All of these years, all of those countries, all of those studies, all of those laboratories, all of those institutions, from time to time they thought they saw a statistically significant correlation between radio exposure, microwave exposure, radar exposure, and grief in their family, whether it be the technician himself or his other family members. So I start off awfully skeptical. I won't say it's impossible, but was it really statistically significant? Was it a large enough cross-section to be valid for making a mathematical analysis of it? If you saw, let me drop. There was a particular NOVA program that appeared about 2 or 3 weeks ago discussing what happens to nutrition and the effects on future generations. And one of the very surprising effects they discovered is that if your particular generation experienced famine, and I'm talking about your great-grandfathers a long time ago, if they experienced famine, and if they were male, and they experienced famine something around 10 and 12 years of age, then extra grief occurred in your offspring downrange. And by the way, it would work backwards. Famine had healthier offspring, and well-fed people, males at 10 to 12, had less healthy offspring. In other words, this peculiar effect of availability of food and the health of the offspring worked a little bit opposite. If you were extremely well-fed, the offspring were not as healthy. So there are certain biological crazy effects that they're now identifying. It's more than just genetics. There's another kind of genetics going on where what you do in your youth is going to have an effect on the offspring you're going to have at some later time, and not necessarily on you. And sometimes it's opposite, as I said. There's different ages of both male and female children that are well-fed and not well-fed that will have various biological problems of their offspring or even their grandchildren. So are we looking at one of these kind of effects in this so-called microwave correlation? As you can tell, I'm starting off awfully skeptical, and we got to do a little more research to find out if it's real. But from time to time, we are all going to be hearing stories about cell phones being unsafe and broadcast transmitters being unsafe and police radios being unsafe and so on. And as you know, we radio-informed people have to slowly educate the people in Bayville that radio is their friend, it's not their enemy. They're trying to eliminate all radio transmitters from that village. It's a sincere effort. They think they're protecting their children. And so we have to slowly educate them on this one. Have you seen any other evidence, Mel? And were you curious enough to start a web search on this German story? And I guess anyone within the sound of our voice can also help us with this research. I'm having trouble.
Repeater, time out.
I'm having trouble believing we're going to read an article that says exactly that in a journal like Science Magazine. K2KEY, K2RIW. And right at that, we're going to pick up with Joe LYY. Yeah. Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, you let everybody go first, but just add this to your little conversation here, is that one of the things, even people that work in the microwave industry, all right, we, up until maybe 20 years ago, built everything. Well, most have built this stuff. And let's just take into one consideration, what's the most common substance that we all use? It's lead, bismuth, antimony, cadmium, you know, just from soldering. What else we got? We got mercury, beryllium oxide, really good stuff, you know. Rare earth oxides that do a really good job. The fluids that we use, phenol, carbon tet, that kind of stuff. I mean, it's been a long time since you've run into asbestos-coated wire, but, you know, it existed. So, I mean, PCBs and capacitors, and old ones anyway. But add that to the mix.
Yeah, very good point. I'm going to pass it over to Mel, and I bet you he's going to tell me that in his youth, like I did, we often saw people doing soldering, and the fumes from the soldering are going up into the guy's nose. And after doing the soldering for a period of time to acquire the skill to get good at it, pretty soon your nose didn't smell the solder fumes anymore. So all the lead and the tin and everything else fumes and the solder resin, we've done a lot of breathing of solder fumes. I can remember once being in a small room in my house and cleaning a printed circuit board with something like carbon tet, and the concentration in the room got so high that I became a little bit dizzy. That's a known carcinogen. So we've all exposed ourselves to all kinds of things back before we knew they were dangerous. So the fact that we radio people exposed ourselves to these other agents can easily lead you to believe that, oh boy, it's the microwaves that did it. I wonder. I'm not so sure. I'm rather skeptical, as you can tell. Percy Spencer, I think is the man's name, who invented the microwave oven. And the story goes that when he's working at Raytheon and has a candy bar in his pocket and walks in front of a microwave magnetron tube that was being tested, the candy bar in his pocket he melted. And he said, gee, that's interesting, and did a little more research. And out came the microwave cooking oven, which were originally, in the old days of around 1950, was called a radar range because it used a radar tube to do microwave cooking. Now everybody calls it not the microwave oven, what it really is. They call it the microwave. By the same token, when we used to have a microwave dish that did television receive-only terminals, people called that the microwave receiver, but they called it the microwave. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Well, I can tell you from experience, direct experience, one thing you did bring up about soldering. Directly, I know of one particular situation that a person that was a family friend that died of lung cancer worked for many years out in Long Island City for a manufacturer of electronic equipment, actually an intercom system, and spent 20 years, I could say, on the assembly line soldering with a number of other women sitting around the table and putting together these units. And when she passed away from lung cancer. And at the funeral, one of the other people that attended the funeral there from another family that also had lost a mother that was a co-worker of hers from the same disease, and they said, oh my gosh, another one from the same thing that makes about six out of the group that died of lung cancer, and they all spent their 20 years at that place or more soldering all day long, Dick. So something there, I think, with those soldering fumes may have contributed to their all getting basically lung cancer over.
And the worst combination I can think of, Mel, is day after day exposing yourself from the soldering fumes. And in those days, we weren't smart enough to have an exhaust fan nearby, a scavenging fan, to remove those fumes. And if the person simultaneously was a smoker, what's your guess as to what percentage of those people who got this lung cancer were simultaneously smokers as well as exposed to the soldering fumes? And that could be a double whammy. Now back to you, Mel.
That's exactly what I said. I said, I questioned this. I said, you know, I'm soldering. I did a lot of soldering, not, you know, 8 hours a day. But I said, well, she was a, you know, smoker. I know she smoked at least maybe a half a pack of cigarettes a day. And I said, ah, that's the key. But I never pursued it any further to question the other people that passed on in that group as to whether or not they were smokers or not. But I have a feeling, because this is going back in the days of, you know, of the old chassis with sockets and the soldering and, you know, with a big old-fashioned, they didn't use a soldering guns or a pencil. No, they used one of those big old heavy irons, those whatever heck they call those irons that you plugged in with a big, big heavy tip on the end of it. And I can say the working situation, no doubt, wasn't good ventilation and everything like that, but definitely there was a link between the two, double whammy link there. Let me let it drop. Now, as far as, you know, you talk about you know, different things that happened with past generations and all. You know, I read a very interesting article one time about concentration victims, concentration camp victims of World War II, that they found that a number of the bodies that were autopsied, that, yes, the people did starve to death under horrible conditions and all, but for some reason, the starvation, as you say, seemed to have reduced the amount of heart disease and cancer, dropped down drastically. So now, what are we thinking? That is that our diet is a big contributor, and now, of course, we're going to a leaner diet. So whether or not, like you say, a next generation, what kind of effect we're actually, are we planting good seeds or bad seeds for our next generation, Dick, over.
And this sounds kind of close to that NOVA program, which talked about the fact that when famine periods occurred in early childhood, you would think those children, the offspring of that child who experienced famine, would be at a disadvantage, and in some cases, they're at an advantage. Whereas when there was a time of plenty with reference to food in that childhood, the next generation or two generations downrange suffered. I guess a factor is that we tend to overeat, obvious by the fact that a significant percentage of our population is overweight, and that does create some relatively serious health hazards. Early mankind didn't have it so good. You could say that by way of evolution and automatic perfection of automatic variation of the species, sort of what Darwin is talking about, that our early ancestors had a lot more periods of famine than they did to feast. And so our bodies are more tuned to properly responding to famine than to feast. There seems to be some evidence of that. So overeating gets you into a fair amount of trouble, particularly if you don't eat the right stuff. But Joe, you signed in earlier, and let's go back to your particular question. W2RYY. Go right ahead, Joe. K2RYW.
Yeah, I had a question from earlier. The problem is I can't get in on the internet. I mean, I should make a statement to K2HA. The way you get the timing set up on the system here, it's worthless to have the internet connected during TechNet, because the people on TechNet absolutely can't get in unless there's about almost 2 seconds of space on the 14685 repeater. If there's anything less than that, because the internet audio delay, by the time you turn over to them, if they want to add something or ask a question, whatever, you're already stepping on them and you take them out of the picture. So this system doesn't work the way it is right now. You have to leave more delay and increase the courtesy tone time between transmissions, because the way it's set up right now, it absolutely doesn't work.
Yeah, that's kind of disappointing. And all of us are pretty quick on the trigger. From your point of view, Joe, what's the length of time that we have to pause in order not to create the grief you're discussing? Back to you, Joe.
I just told you that. It takes about about 3/4 of a second delay just between the Glen Oaks repeater and the Selden repeater, at least 3/4 of a second delay. The IRLP's got to encode the audio, put it into the internet, it's got to decode the audio the other end. You're going to reflect, which is doing the same thing. So when this audio comes out of the other people's repeaters at the other end, the same kind of time delay probably applies, maybe even more. So by the time you hear your courtesy tone and you don't hear a reply, you're mashing on the microphone and you're already stepping on the people, because the audio in Glen Oaks has priority over the other audio coming in. And so this is why when you turn over to people, you don't get a response back. You got to leave 2 seconds of space minimum to get a response back from the internet.
Okay, so what you're saying then is a significant increase over what Eric was saying. Eric was saying that if we wait through the courtesy tone, he thought we'd be okay. That courtesy tone is a fraction of a second. I think you're saying a full 2 seconds is required because of the delay to and back out of IRLP. So you're saying a full 2 seconds is required. Eric also said that once every 2 minutes and 40 seconds, we have to let everything drop to make sure that we're not causing a timeout of the IRLP. I think I've got that closer to correct, Joe, from E2RYY, K2RIW.
If you want to demonstrate this to yourself, try running the TechNet from 147.375 and see how successful you are. Because I guarantee you, you'll end up talking to yourself.
Okay, I hear you. So we have to leave longer delays. Now, you signed in earlier with a real question, so why don't you go ahead with your question, Joe?
If I can remember what it is now, you were talking about a couple of various things. You're talking about, well, I'll get to my question in a moment. Let me just make a comment. You talked about attenuators and talking about bunny hunts. I had a KDK FM 144 I used to use about 30 years ago when I got into the bunny hunt thing. That's about when I started doing that kind of stuff out on the Sullivan repeater. And what I simply did was I dropped the voltage for the RF amplifier in the front end of the radio because I found exactly that happening. The external outboard attenuator was a 40 dB K attenuator, basically ended up being useless as soon as you got within about a quarter to an eighth of a mile away from the bunny. You couldn't attenuate anymore. The stuff was just leaking right through the case of the radio, so I found by dropping the voltage to the, completely dropping the voltage to the first RF stage in the radio, that added about 25 to 35 dB of attenuation, additional attenuation in the radio. Now it made the thing a little more useful with the outboard attenuator. Back to you.
Okay, that's a pretty crafty idea. So rather going through all the rigmarole of building the offset attenuator, differential attenuator, active attenuator as it's called, simply create a switch somewhere in the system, set the VDD, the voltage that operates the very first transistor amplification stage of your radio, is turned off. Instead of it having 15 dB of gain, it'll have 20 dB of loss, and therefore all signals get 35 dB weaker, and your receiver that used to be overloaded is not overloaded anymore. Very crafty. And if that wasn't enough, you could go one step further. Turn off the voltage supply to the first IF stage. Now you really got an attenuator. So turn off enough of the stages of your radio. Maybe in some cases, for a guy who's not afraid to climb inside his radio and make changes and add switches that can be flipped, to kill the sensitivity of the receiver, boy, that is easy. We spend our whole life learning how to make the lowest possible noise figure receiver to make it the most sensitive. To make it desensitized should be easy. That's what I think you're telling us, Joe. It's a good thing to remember. It's a simple approach. Keep it simple, stupid. And ain't nothing simpler than just turning something off. Back to you, Joe, for your real question. W2RYY, with a delay. K2RIW.
Okay. Real question. I know you talk about frequent money. I'm not sure what the other night is. It's going back about 4, 5, 6 months ago. 5 months ago, something like that. Just before we had the rain, the front move in from a few days back because it got cloudy. It was hard to see this thing. Looking from my house at about 320 degrees or so, I saw something. It wasn't a star, and I wasn't sure if it was like an evening, what they call an evening star, like Venus or possibly Mercury. I'm not sure what I'm looking at. The thing was fixed in the sky, fairly bright, and instead of being like a sparkling white color, this thing had, you could see it was white with red and also blue. It almost looked like an aircraft stationary, but at an extremely high altitude, but very, very bright. I don't know what this was, what I was actually looking at. But I thought it was rather interesting. I just thought I'd bring it up if anybody else has ever encountered something like this that seems like this. And no, I don't think it was a UFO.
Okay, so it was very bright, and if I understand you correctly, multiple colors. 320 degrees of azimuth. You said very high. I'm going to make a guess that it was like 60 degrees above your horizon. And by the way, an easy way for a person to make an estimation of how high something is above the horizon is to recognize that when you close your fist and hold your fist at full arm's length in front of you, the bottom of your fist to the top of your fist is very close to a 10 degree angle compared to your particular eyesight. So next time you want to try this experiment, hold the fist out in front of you and make the bottom of your fist right on the horizon if you're in a clear spot where you really can see the horizon. And then stack fists one above the other, and you'll rapidly realize that 9 fists later, 10 times 90 degrees, 9 times 10 degrees each fist is 10 degrees, you'll be straight up ahead, 90 degrees up. So estimating elevation with your fist is pretty easy. And once you realize that, then estimating with your finger held horizontal at arm's length, is very close to 2 degrees vertical angle. So you can estimate rather nicely elevation angle. So I'm going to guess that this is like 60 degrees up. How long did it last, Joe? What color did you see? How big was it compared to Jupiter or Venus? How long did this apparition last? WQRYY, KQRYW.
Well, I have to get up at about like 1:30, I don't know, 1:30, quarter to 2 in the morning, and just go to the front of my door and look out the side door and start looking out there. I had to look up, and it basically was, it was even with the phone pole that I only caught street, but quite a ways above it. So I would say it was about 56 degrees up. It wasn't an aircraft. It was not moving. The thing was fixed in location because I kept on looking at it compared to a the vision of the pole, and it was like diagonally a little east of where the pole would be, just slightly. And that pole would be about like 310 degrees or something like that from my house approximately, between my antenna aims. So it estimated up looking up to about 320, something like that. And it was at a fixed location in altitude, so I was definitely looking at something extremely high up that wasn't visible. And it was predominantly, but you could see it like a trace of red and a trace of blue at the edge of this thing. But white being predominantly the major color that my eye saw. That's what this thing looked like. Don't know what it is. Never seen something like this before. I'm just wondering if anybody else has ever experienced the same thing out there. And then just gazing at night at the sky.
Now, if you've ever used a telescope, Joe, to look at, say, for instance, Mercury. Mercury never gets very far above the horizon. So you're looking through the atmosphere at a slanting angle. With a telescope, Mercury will always have a funny color to it. It's a white planet, per se, but you will see a bluish color along the upper edge and a reddish along the lower edge. There's a slim chance I got this backwards. But the atmospheric refraction is color sensitive. The moon, stars, anything with any real diameter to it, stars not so much, but any planet that's close to the horizon will have a red ring above its upper edge and a blue ring below its lower edge. I got it backwards. That's the blue up top, red on the bottom, because of atmospheric refraction. On top of that, most objects in the sky that are celestial, like Moon, Mercury, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, Mars, most of those objects move very slowly compared to Earth's rotation. Earth rotates 15 degrees per hour. So therefore, if you looked at that object for a good fraction of an hour and calculated how fast it moved, if it's a true celestial object, it'll move roughly 15 degrees per hour. 1.5 fists per hour is the rate at which it'll move. I wonder if you looked at it long enough to sense that rate of motion. So, WQRYY, KQRIW.
KCQI.
Glenn recognized, but Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
I did like look at it for like the time, and it did appear that they moved slightly eastward, or rotating from the position of 320 degrees. Maybe it moved, say, it's like a bearing of, say, possibly 325 or something like that. But it took a while to do it. Now, what you said makes sense, because the thing was red at the top and blue at the, say if you're calling straight up north or at 0 degrees, red was coming from that edge of this object. The blue was, say, at 120 degrees, approximately. But most of it being predominantly white.
Okay, sounds kind of good. Glenn, go ahead.
Just kind
of interesting that in the northern, very, very close to the horizon, early morning, I think that's actually the, we might want to check the call later, but that might have been the ISS, International Space Station, because that coordinate system set pretty darn close to where they say you can observe it very early in the morning on a clear morning, to almost directly due north and very, very close to the horizon. Back to you, Dick, K2RW, KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, I've got a bit of a problem here, though. If one of the orbits of the International Space Station went directly overhead of you, from first sensing it on your, let's assume it went from west to east, from first sensing it on the western horizon until it goes overhead and then you lose it on the eastern horizon, that period of time is roughly 18 minutes. Directly overhead, 18 minutes is all you can see. International Space Station. And if it's a grazing shot where it just barely goes over your northern hemisphere or your southern hemisphere, you're going to see it for a much more brief period of time. What Joe is describing has got two problems. The red and the green seems reasonable. The brightness that he's describing so far, the altitude, the angle, so far reasonable. But because of the way the Earth rotates, everything has what's called a western progression, right ascension. In other words, all objects proceed toward our western horizon and then disappear. Everything rotates in that direction because of the way the Earth rotates. And Joe is saying that this particular object moved to his east. It didn't move west. So now we got a little bit of a problem. Any slim possibility that it... Okay. I'm going to turn it back to Joe to see if he can explain this one. It sounds like you looked for about a 20-minute period of time, and in 20 minutes, the International Space Station will stay in your view, in your field of view. I'm having trouble believing it's the International Space Station. Although the International Space Station, down nowadays where it's got so darn many great big solar panels, you can get all kinds of brightness and colors out of that when it's fresher than you just right. Particularly if it's up in the sunlight and you're down in the dark. What time of night was this, Joe? You did say late at night, but I wonder, was it 3 o'clock in the morning, just before sunrise, so to speak? From E2RYY, K2RW, with delay.
WS2N.
Call recognized, but go first. Go right ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2RYW.
Oh, okay, yeah. I heard him say 2 o'clock in the morning. Mercury would have to be closer to like 4, maybe 3:30 or something like that. I know it's right before dawn or right after dusk. I mean, it's not there long. I mean, it's there. I mean, you know, when the sun is up, it's there. You just can't see it. But you need that darkness. And it's usually at that time frame. I don't know, 2 o'clock seems a little early. Maybe not. No, maybe it's right on the edge. So I thought I'd make that comment. The space station, well, I never heard a follow-up of the 15-degree story, so to find out if it was a true celestial object, if it moved, you know, within that, you know, 6, 8, 10 minutes, then you could say it was a satellite or a space station. And put me down for a comment, update on something with this video. Cleaning system. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. Yeah, he did say it moved to the east and 50 degrees above his horizon. Mercury never gets there. Venus does. Venus, Jupiter, Mars, Saturn, they all are very bright objects at times and can be very far above the horizon. Almost always, though, more to the south. You don't see it to the north. He did say 320 degrees. You don't see, that's northwest. You don't see Venus. You don't see any of the planets in the ecliptic. Ecliptic really means the path, the plane of the path where the sun travels. And that's where your planets are located. The only one that's slightly off of the ecliptic is Pluto. And Pluto you're not going to see with anything except a pretty darn good telescope. A really good sized one. So, the angle that he saw this, 320 degrees, can't be a planet. Moving to the east, as opposed to moving to the west, planet. If he saw it for more than 18 minutes, it can't be the International Space Station or any low Earth orbit satellite. A much higher Earth orbit satellite is certainly possible, but even they move a lot faster than this. I'm going to turn it over to Joe. If anyone else got any comments, give me your call letters, K2RIW. Okay. Dave, what do you think it is?
I have to ask a question. I tuned in a little late, so I didn't hear the initial observation report. And I was just curious, what set it apart? Why is he concerned about this object, and what exactly did it appear?
Okay, I'm going to tell you what I heard, and I'm going to turn it over to Joe for corrections. 2 o'clock in the morning, he gets up, looks out his back door, his side door, and at 320 degrees, he's seeing this object 50 degrees above the horizon. 320 degrees is northwest, 50 degrees up. A rather bright object, which was blue on the top and red on the bottom, just like a, when you look through a telescope at something close to the horizon, the atmospheric refraction gives you that effect. And this thing moved very slowly to the east. So he saw a bright object high in the sky, slowly moving to the east, 2 o'clock in the morning. So B2RYY for any further comments, K2RYW.
That's pretty much correct. I would gauge, if you're using fingers and hands, I would gauge the thing went moved, say, about the space of a quarter inch in the sky in a space of maybe 10 or 12 minutes. That's how slow this thing was apparently moving with the, using the telephone pole as a positional fixed reference. So that's what I pretty much saw. It was about 50 or so degrees above the sky, and I'd say 90 degrees is straight up. So this thing is about a little higher than halfway between the straight up and what the horizon would be. So I'd estimate about 50 degrees. And it was definitely multicolored. I have seen Venus as an evening star, so I know what that looks like. That's usually pretty much brilliantly white. And this thing definitely had tinges of color behind it. White predominantly with red. And red looked like it was at the top, and blue looked like, say, it was 90 to 120 degrees on the eastern side of whatever this object was.
Joe, what was the total length of time, beginning to end, rough estimate, that you observed this object? And did you come back later and look for it again?
I noticed the object at about 1:40 in the morning, and I was standing there looking at the doorway to about maybe 1:55 or so. And that's why I say this thing had it moved about, say, a quarter inch in the sky. Positional change, about a quarter inch or so that I could estimate by eye in that amount of time.
Okay. That's too long to be an aircraft, too long to be the space station or any other low Earth orbit satellite, moving in the wrong direction to be a celestial object. So you've got a difficult one to explain there. But Paul is going to tell us what it is. I'm having some fun with Paul. He's also going to tell us what NASA is doing. WS2N, our space expert. Make sure you wait for a full courtesy tone and 1 or 2 seconds beyond. A2RIW, you get the call.
Not hearing a tone, Dick.
Yeah, neither am I. Whatever it is on the eastern input. I'm getting a potent signal on the eastern input.
Aliens again.
Not good. Maybe it was a weather balloon. I mean, it sounds like it's moving along with us, Dick, by the way. Might have been a weather balloon. And at that time in the morning, might have been reflecting the sun, right, reflecting off of it. No, they sent a bunch of weather balloons up there for that launch that they had from Virginia. Let's see if I time this out.
Not yet, so proceed.
I mean, that's my only possibility, some weather balloon. NASA, well, they had a spacecraft crashed into the south pole of the moon. I watched it, and I didn't see a big flare-up. It did not live up to the expectations of the animation that they kept showing. But the science, teams did record a lot of information, and they're looking through it. It's going to take about 2 weeks to find out if any warning shot up into space. Let me drop it. Sounds like it. I don't know. Okay. We'll gamble a little bit, Dick. I just wanted to make a comment about the update on the video head cleaning thing I talked about a while back. I didn't get the chamois sticks, not yet. The company does make them, MG Chemicals, but this other company, MG Chemicals, also makes these. They're actually officially cotton swabs, but they're really good. They're on these 6-inch long birch sticks, and they're made for electronics and optical things, and I do have a bag of these now. I might even try it. I mean, you cannot even pull the cotton swabs off of this. I mean, it's really a tight weave, whatever it is. And it's meant for raw electronics and things. Might have a shot with the video heads with this. Probably be okay. But this company does sell it. I just have to... availability problem. You know, I probably have to get it on the internet. This I did not. I actually bought it in a store. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. Sounds like the right thing for doing cleaning. I know they don't recommend cotton swabs because it sometimes leaves fibers behind. But you're a guy with a good enough set of eyes, with a good magnifying glass, you'll know if something gets left behind. And that's why the chamois is better.
Reflector, 9-1-2-6, link clear.
All right, Dick, I disconnected Sheldon. The problem's not coming from Sheldon.
Understand. What do you recommend we do, Eric?
It could be coming from Las Vegas, but I kind of doubt it. I haven't heard this machine recycle itself.
You're correct. We've all waited, and it doesn't recycle. Maybe there's a weak carrier on the input. I've been doing some listening on the input, and I'm not hearing anything right now. But I'm both quiet. Eric, you got it, Eric.
Stand by a second. I'm going to do something. Let's see if we can locate it.
Repeater, time out.
That's coming in, Dave, but
I hear you. Overly coincidental, the machine came back on at the instant I made a transmission on the eastern input jar, right?
There's something the input of the machine. You don't hear it, do you?
If it's there, it's relatively weak. Let me do a little more listening.
Everything, but until nothing happens, until the carrier drops, unfortunately. So I'm trying to figure a good way around it, because it's just going to time out again.
Net, at 8 o'clock, this is WQEL repeater.
Just for the heck of it, Eric, put the machine back into the PL mode. There's a slim chance that the PL tone is the wrong one.
Yeah, that's possible. Let's see. See if I can get it to do that.
Repeater, timeout.
Channel 6. Radical, you on what?